time to podcast.
Welcome everyone into the Hyper Time. The Hyper Time to podcast. And I am excited to bring you the first episode of four this month. That's right, no bye weeks this month. Four episodes. And today is the first one. And before we get into that, let me introduce my co-host, Alan Muir. Alan, how are you doing today?
Well, the last episode we recorded chronologically did horrible on Anchor.
Oh, did it?
Two plays.
Yeah. The numbers haven't been great, but...
I mean,
you
know, every...
What can you do?
The episodes have been doing well on YouTube, or one of the episodes, the Avengers one.
Oh,
or All-Star, or the JSA episode. They've been doing well on Anchor, but yeah, it was sort of like, nobody wants to hear what I want to say.
I hear you. Well, hopefully that changes this month specifically, because it's not an old comic per se that we're going to be talking about. It's probably one of the best the biggest icons that this industry has seen, not only in the comic realm, but in the animated side of it as well. So yeah, this month we're going to focus two episodes specifically on this creator. Next week's episode will be on a company that he helped start. And then the fourth episode will be kind of us looking back at the different works of this creator and the company he worked for. So, Alan, do you kind of want to mention who this is that we're going to be discussing today?
Yes, it is one of my favorite people throughout his history of men, and that is Dwayne McDuffie.
So good. And I loved spending the time looking at Dwayne this month. I mean, if you could go back and look at any of his interviews, please do so. That man is just so fascinating to listen to. It's a shame he's gone, because I would love to see kind of where he would be today, along with stuff like, you know, the Milestone relaunch that they're trying to get off the ground here at DC. You know, reading all these interviews, going over all this stuff, it's such a depressing thing knowing that he's no longer with us, because he has probably one of the biggest impacts on this industry, and he is a legend. And I don't think he will ever get the credit that he deserves. Even, you know, he gets plenty of credit. People know who Dwayne McDuffie is, but I don't think they understand just how impactful his time in comics have been.
I mean, to be fair, he had a character like that had a character just has his last name.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm not sure if that was Bendis's idea or David Walker's idea. They're the co-writers of the book.
Yeah, I know you've commented on it a few times about how... Because she is a good character, right?
Yeah, Naomi McDuffie is one of the best recently created characters that DC has ever made. I kind of hope that she is a part of Future State, considering that she'd be perfect for that timeline. And like, she has appeared in like the mainline DC books, like very like little cameos or guest spots. But man, season one of her solo book, so good.
I'll have to give that a read sometime. Yeah, so I see a little thing here. I looked it up, trying to see if I could narrow it down who created her. It just says that she was co-created by David Walker. What I didn't know is that, you know, the industry has the Dwayne McDuffie Award for Diversity in Comics, which started in 2015. And apparently David Walker was one of the recipients for his work on Shaft for Dynamite Entertainment. So there's a little extra tie in there that I didn't know was a thing.
Some connective thread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so specifically with this episode, we are going to discuss Dwayne McDuffie pre-Milestone. I figured it was probably best to kind of separate this out into three different episodes. And so the first one will be pre-Milestone. Next week's will be all of Milestone. And then the third week will be post-Milestone up until his death. So this one will probably be the least beefy of the episodes. And the other two will probably be a little on the daunting side, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. So is there anything else you would like to mention before we kind of get into all this here?
I was going to say something bad about Paul Levitz. based on like the impasse they had.
Yeah, that might be better next week when we bring that up.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna. I have a feeling we're gonna kind of vent on that come next week. So, with Dwayne, he was born in Detroit on February 20th, 1962. His parents were Leroy McDuffie, who was an employee at the Federal Reserve, and his mother was Edna McDuffie Gardner, who was a nurse. And both of them tried their hardest to give McDuffie the best possible future that they could. They worked incredibly hard, both working extra shifts to afford Dwayne going to the Roper School, which is a private school for gifted children. And they did that. They worked their butts off. They got him in, and clearly it worked out for him in the long run. So growing up, he often considered himself what he called a proto nerd. While he would do stuff like play sports, he also loved comics and the science fair and all that stuff. But when it came to sports, he would do stuff like be an all-state goalie for soccer in high school. He loved playing ice hockey growing up and was a Red Wings fan. He also did stuff like martial arts and boxing, baseball, and basketball. And for anyone who does not know McDuffie, this man is like 6'7", so I don't know entirely when he was fully grown, but I imagine seeing someone of Dwayne's size in sports was probably one of the most daunting and terrifying things to see if you were up against him.
You just see him coming at you, like running towards you.
You know, as I've kind of looked at different interviews from different people talking about Dwayne, his size is something they would often mention, because I guess people would often mistake him for a football player or a basketball player or something. And then he would pull out some book with like quantum mechanics or whatever and start reading it. This guy goes completely against what they imagine he is like. So Dwayne was first introduced to comics through an outing with his father and some of his friends. While his father would buy the other kids candy, Dwayne didn't really have any interest in that. Instead, he would receive two comics. One was an issue of Adventure Comics that had a ton of superheroes on the cover, and which was something he thought was a deal, you know, having a comic with a ton of characters as opposed to just one. And specifically, this was with the Legion of Superheroes, and he had seen Bouncing Boy on the cover. And he thought it was crazy about seeing this large kid just bouncing around like a ball.
Okay, this makes sense now. That episode, one of the many episodes of Justice League Unlimited, when they time travel, they travel to the Legion of Superheroes time, and Bouncing Boy is among, like, the episode starts with the Legion, or with members of the Legion being hunted, but it's all like, it's not in your face hardcore rated stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, you like your cartoonish stuff. And I, as soon as I saw Bouncing Boy, if my life were a cartoon, my jaw would have sunk to the floor.
Yeah, of the several interviews he was talking about, like what got him into comics, he would always bring up this comic, and it was all specifically Bouncing Boy he would always reference as to why he loved it so much, which is great, because that's part of the reason I love Legion of Superheroes, is just kind of how dumb some of the superheroes can be, like Matter Eater Lad and all that. And so outside of Adventure Comics, there was also an issue of Sugar and Spike, which was a book about toddlers who can communicate through baby talk. And so these specific two issues are what made him a fan for life. Not only did they help teach him to read, but they helped develop his imagination and dream of things that could, you know, be possibilities further down the line.
By the time you're listening to this, listeners, the episode I'm referring to will have been months and months ago. Did you ever read the anthology Legends of Tomorrow series?
No, I did not.
They brought Sugar and Spike back.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Were they still toddlers, or did they try and change something out?
They were adults.
Ah, okay.
Who I think they were solving mysteries.
Hmm.
I had no idea who they were, because they hadn't been, like, I seen or read nothing of them during my time reading comics.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever heard of them before searching this stuff up. Funny how this stuff like comes back around.
Yeah, very.
So although those were his two books that got him into comics, there was one specific book that kind of changed his life. This was in 1973 when his friend Alan Tompkins, who according to him knew everything about comics, they had been talking about an issue where the Hulk would fight Thor, which would end up being an issue of Defenders number 10. And this was often a discussion between the two of them as to who would win. And Dwayne always thought the Hulk. Alan thought Whore. Whore. Oh my God. Delete that from.
So.
Alan thought Thor. So they devised a plan to go out to their good comic book shop, which was called Lindsay Drug, which was 3 miles away. And this was where when they were kids. So Dwayne told his mom he was going over to Alan's, and just like that, off they went on their bikes. Sadly, the book was nowhere to be found, but not wanting to leave empty-handed, he saw an issue that caught his eye, so he bought it. And it was Jungle Action number 6, which featured the Black Panther. And while Black Panther wasn't the first black character he had seen in comics, it was the first one that left an impression on him. In Dwayne's own words, he says this about that comic. In those days when black people in comics weren't busy being angry, they appeared either as faithful sidekicks or worse, as helpless victims who begged white superheroes to rescue them. How come you never did nothing for the black skins, Mr. Green Lantern? And this was actually progress. The Black Panther was nobody's sidekick, and if there was any rescuing to do, he'd take care of himself. Cute. Moreover, the Black Panther was king of a mythical African country where black people were visible in every position in society. Soldier, doctor, philosopher, street sweeper, ambassador. Suddenly, everything was possible. In the space of 15 pages, black people moved from invisible to inevitable. I've spoken ad nauseum about the importance of multiculturalism in fiction, as in life. I've preached about the sense of validation a kid feels when they see their image reflected heroically in the mass media. This particular summer afternoon, reading about the dastardly, but nuanced, Eric Killmonger's villainous plot to usurp the Black Panther's rightful throne is precisely when it happened to me. I realized that these stories could be about me, that I could be the hero. Years later, writing in my own comic, I described that wonderful feeling as the sudden possibility of flight. Milestone Comics was, among many other things, an attempt to pass that feeling along. It's all about gaining the high ground. From up there, you gain the perspective to allow you to see the many possibilities open to you. This issue of Jungle Action single-handedly revealed to me that there were new heights to reach, new vistas to view. It also, not incidentally, entertained the hell out of me. Seriously, I love listening to this man speak.
Did you ever watch the Watchmen HBO series from last year?
No. That's on HBO, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have HBO, so I wasn't able to watch it.
The actor who plays Yahya Abdul-Mateen, I'm going to butcher his name, Yahya Abdul-Mateen, he was in Aquaman. He played...
I haven't seen that either.
Well, nevertheless, he played Aquaman's greatest villain.
Oh, Black Manta?
Yeah. He plays a character that becomes very relevant in Watchmen. There's an episode where he was wearing a mask. So all you heard was... all you could tell from him, like, was that he was talking. I swear he sounded so much like Dwayne McDuffie.
That's fine, because there's going to be, I don't know if I have it in this one, it'll be in the third episode, a funny story about, yeah, it looks like in the third episode, about someone also mistaking Dwayne McDuffie for somebody else. So, regarding the story about him, you know, running off to the drugstore to buy this comic, his mother knew that she lied to him and where he was going, so he was actually punished for lying to her and doing this. And for 40 years, she never told him how she figured it out. Apparently, this is something that Dwayne would occasionally ask her to see if he could get from her. How did she know? So Eugene Sun, who is someone that worked with Dwayne on, I think it was just the animation side, like Ben 10. You know, Eugene would ask his mother after Dwayne's death as to how she figured it out. and she said it was quite simple. She saw him counting his money prior to him telling her he was going to Alan's house. So when that is what he claimed he was going to do, she knew he was lying. And she said, a mother always knows. So good.
Yeah.
And so when it came to comics, he found himself drawn to writers more so than artists. Growing up, some of his favorites were Jerry Conway on Spider-Man, Steve Gerber on Howard the Duck and Defenders, and Steve Englehart on Avengers. Now, despite, you know, all of that introduction into comics, he never really saw it as a means of profession until many years later. In college, where he went to the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, he actually earned a bachelor's degree in English and a master's degree in physics. And while there, he would toy around with some films for fun. And he thought these turned out pretty well, as they were all comedies and were character and performance-based films. Then he would later follow this up when he went to New York City and attended the New York University Tisch School of Arts. But according to him, he had much less fun there, and he felt it showed in his work, which he called dreadful. And some of his favorite directors, which I'm sure you could kind of see bleed into his work, is like Woody Allen, Preston Sturges, and Paddy Chayefsky. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. You know, this wouldn't shine through his work at school, but he did try and channel it the best he could through Justice League Unlimited and Ben 10 Alien Force, among other things. And apparently, it's sad that we never actually got to see the projects he always dreamed of working on. According to, I think it was Charlotte, his wife, who had mentioned this, is that he always wanted to do romantic comedies.
Oh, man. That
and he would have been wonderful doing that.
I'm not coming around and saying he did get a chance to do it. He got a chance to do so in the lightest sense with or certain stuff with Just League Unlimited show.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, I think he tried to work through some of that with like Hot Girl and Green Lantern and them, but
yeah, and then there was stuff with Huntress and The Question.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one. I need to go back and rewatch all those. It's been a long time.
They're all in DC Universe. until they change their name to officially to DC Infinity.
God, I still hate that name. So speaking of Woody Allen, that is actually who Dwayne attributes his ability to write to. He would often transcribe Allen's stand-up routines and then use that to understand the hows and whys Allen did what he did. Preston Sturges is who helped him learn screenplay writing. Back when he was trying to learn all this, it was very hard for people to get access to screenplays, but Sturges actually had a book with 5 of his screenplays in it. And so he was able to pick that up, and that's how he learned the ability to write screenplays. And then kind of as he was figuring himself out after film school, he was writing under a pseudonym for stand-up comedians and David Letterman's Late Show. And it was actually his time working as a copy editor for Investment Dealer's Digest that would lead to him at Marvel specifically. While working there in 1987, he complained about his job to his friend Greg Wright, who was working at Marvel Comics. And his friend told him, like, hey, Marvel needs an assistant editor. Why don't you try it out? So Dwayne took a shot, and within the following week, he was working under Bob, probably pronounced his name wrong again, Bob Budiansky. And Dwayne often jokes that the only reason he was hired was because Bob was going on vacation that same week and needed someone as soon as possible. So Dwayne was hired. Bob left him notes that Dwayne lost after a day or two, but he didn't burn the place down, so he felt he was at least doing something decent while he was there. And outside of Budiansky, many of the other people that helped McDuffie, such as Sid Jacobson, who was once the editor-in-chief of Harvey Comics. Jacobson is who McDuffie credits as educating him on writing comics in a visual sense, which also helped him when he decided to move to television. Someone who always encouraged what he did at Marvel was Mark Gruenwald, who was a writer and editor there and helped give McDuffie confidence in his work. And then, of course, Archie Goodwin and Ernie Cohen, who were also important in his mentoring as well there at Marvel.
Yeah, he mentions in the video where he, it was just an example of how brilliant and knowledgeable he was about culture and everything, about how Luke Cage got the Sweet Christmas one. Archie Goodwin, who was writing Luke Cage, wanted to use authentic language, and he started reading a work by Chester Himes.
Huh.
And little did he know that Chester Himes was actually screwing with everyone. So, like, what he thought was a way to make things feel organic turned out to be just Chester Himes writing dark comedies set in Harlem. If I recall correctly, one of his novels is Blind Man with a Pistol. And it's one of those things where you just have, you need to watch the video, because McDuffie is just, he's on the ball the entire time.
Yeah, if you could find that video, go ahead and send me a link and I'll attach it to the source notes for this episode.
Will do.
And so I found a quote, and I don't know if this was necessarily kind of what he set out to do while he was at Marvel, but clearly this was something he knew was a problem well ahead of time. Yeah, he was aware of how, like, poor black characters were represented in comics. So I think he had it in mind when he started working in comics to change that. And he had an interview with New York Times in 1993 in which he stated, "You only had two types of characters available for children. You had the stupid, angry brute and the he's smart, but he's black characters. And they were all colored either this Hershey bar shade of brown, a sickly looking gray or purple. I've never seen anyone that's gray or purple before in my life. There's no diversity and almost no accuracy among the characters of color at all."
I mean, yeah, he's kind of right on that one.
Yeah. Like, he kind of nails it. Like, even today, you still run across characters who very much fit the, like, angry black man kind of approach. It's the more things change, the more they stay the same, essentially. It's a shame stuff like that still hasn't improved as much as it needs to.
Yeah, he mentions that there's a character, one of the characters is during Will Eisner's run on the Spirit.
I know who you're talking about. I saw him mention it too.
And the character looks just, oh my god, how did that get around? Like, how that
was it Ebony White?
Yeah.
Which in itself is a racial pun.
And I'm trying to remember how he looked exactly.
Yeah, I looked it up. He looks like a little gremlin.
Yeah. Oh god, yeah.
You know, it has that very, like, I wish I had a picture of here before I just start talking like I remember exactly. But, like, he's even more racist looking than a lot of the cartoons I remember watching growing up. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, like, you have the main character who looks real, and then you have Ebony White, who looks like he was Photoshopped in before Photoshop existed.
I wish I could find that quote. Yeah, I mean, he's 100% right. Like, black characters just, especially the color. And that was something that I always kind of weirded me out reading out, like, old comics. But I never really thought much of it outside of it just being a dumb coloring issue. But yeah, like, having black characters be this weird purplish, I'm trying to think of, like, the closest thing to the purple I can think of. But yeah, it's one of those things that will never get corrected if they don't have someone of a black person to come in and correct that. Especially back in, you know, late 80s, early 90s. And he took that on himself to do that. And he did a great job for everything he could do, at least. So McDuffie was eventually given a shot to write at comics, and he nailed it. He credits Greg Wright for giving him the opportunity to pitch stories for the Avengers. And within a few weeks, he created the beloved Damage Control with Ernie Cullen. This brought out his humor, and it made it very difficult for him to get work on non-comedy superhero books. He also wrote a few runs on Deathlok, and it was his first real ongoing run, which is also his personal favorite, which also led to him meeting and gaining a friendship with fellow Milestone co-founder Dennis Cowan. His run would change up Deathlok in a way while doing it very carefully. They tried to reinvent the character as a new character for a newer audience. They knew they had to make changes. The original premise for Deathlok was already outdated. For example, it took place in 1985, but they were writing the book in 1987. So clearly there wouldn't be a world where cannibals were roaming New York and guns didn't fire lasers. And so they tried to do little updates here and there, I think specifically one of the updates was they tried to show Deathlok as like the $6 million man, where only he could have this kind of technology to do what it can in this time. And I think they actually reverted a lot of that when McDuffie left the books, to where everybody on the streets had that kind of tech. Have you read any of his Deathlok or Damage Control or anything?
I technically have the ability to because of Marvel Unlimited.
Mm. Yeah, I think I've read some of his Deathlok, but Damage Control, I think I've only read a few issues. I don't think they were... I think there were more recent stuff than... I think... Did they have something in the 2000s?
Man.
For some reason, I'm thinking like around Civil War, maybe. But I can't...
I mean, if there was Damage Control mini or tie-in...
That may have been it. It may have been like a little mini series or something that's spun off of it. I feel like that's probably my only introduction into Damage Control, which is like a brilliant idea of having this group of individuals who goes around cleaning up after superhero disasters and whatnot.
I mean, they did the ultimate honor of adding it officially to the like more multimedia stuff.
Oh yeah,
like in Spider-Man, you can find and take a photograph of the Damage Control headquarters, and. Then obviously the MCU Spider-Man Homecoming begins with the formation of Damage Control. And yeah, there, during Civil War, there was a storyline revolving around Damage Control and Civil War, Irredeemable Ant-Man, and then the first issue of World War Hulk after Smash, Damage Control.
I think that may have been my first introduction to them. Because at that time, I was trying to build by all of the like tie-ins to World War Hulk. So I think that is probably where I first had been introduced to them.
Yeah, and I just love the pitch as basically a sitcom within the Marvel Universe. Like, that is a fantastic idea.
Yeah, it's one of those ideas that you hear about and you're like, why didn't anyone think of that beforehand? So yeah, I think for our fourth week, I'm going to try to go back and read some of his starting run on Damage Control.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to, like... They still haven't put more milestone stuff on Comixology.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm still waiting. Like, I want to... Like, I bought the Zadok Return of the something. Like, it was a 2001 book.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Miniseries. But apparently the first collection of the original run starts on... By the time we're recording this in December.
Yeah, we have some sales going on at some local shops that sell old comics. And so today I found a few issues of like Hardware and Blood Syndicate and Zombie. So I'm debating whether or not to go tomorrow to another of the same shops and see if I can find any more.
Josh, if you find any doubles, I will pay you for them.
Okay. Is there any specifics that you want?
Like Hardware, Icon, you know, Blood Syndicate.
It's all like the initial four core books.
Yeah.
Okay. So there was also a moment that Tom Brevoort mentions as a good example of how persuasive Dwayne could be. This was specifically regarding Deathlok. So McDuffie referenced W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a black theorist and historian, and specifically referenced the souls of black folk and used it to title it an arc that he was writing titled The Souls of Cyberfolk. For some reason, which isn't fully explained, and this is possibly just not knowing where the reference came from, Bob Budiansky changed the story arc name to Cyber War, and it went so far as to being relettered on the cover until Dwayne McDuffie came back into his office, I think after a vacation, and when he realized there was a change to his story arc and the name of it, he went to Bob and fought for the original title, and push to have it changed back and end up working. It's just a good little exchange of like, this book is almost complete. It is almost complete, period. And Dwayne is able to go in there and be like, no, like it needs to be this. Like there's a reason for this. Let's please change it back. He was able to basically have him redo all of that work up until that point. So regarding Deathlok, this is kind of Dwayne's comments on his approach. Deathlok was supposed to be a modern-day take on Marvel's The Thing, a man alienated by his surface appearance. as well as my own commentary on the grim and gritty trend in comic book heroes. Contrary to the fashion at the time, I wanted to do a superhero who is more moral than I, not less. So I'm curious how that turns out when I go to read it. So not only with his writing, but behind the scenes, he was also impressing people. Tom Brevoort was starting to work at Marvel during that time and worked with him quite a bit. And he actually has this to say about McDuffie and specifically his approach that would help McDuffie become one of the biggest and important names in comics. He says, Dwayne was probably the smartest man working on staff when I started as an office intern in 1989. A very gregarious and fun-loving person. Dwayne was far more plugged into questions on race and representation than anybody else at Marvel in those days, and that caused him to butt up against people when he saw something being done that he thought was ill-informed or just plain wrong. He was never shy about expressing his opinion, and he was deadly with a quip and a sharp line. Because he wasn't happy with the way that characters who look like him were depicted in comics, Dwayne worked on trying to create better representation for people of all kinds in his work. That most notably took the form of his launch of Milestone Media, distributed by DC, where he and his collaborators create a wide assortment of characters, the best known of whom today is probably Static. I saved the mock pitch he wrote up for Teenage Negro Ninja Thrashers, after not one, but two black skateboard running characters were suddenly parading around the Marvel Universe at the same time. It was featured years later in a museum exhibit dedicated to the depiction of characters of color in comics. And so, if you hear this episode, please go to VG.TV, where we will post this episode, and I will use one of the images there to show his pitch for Teenage Negro Ninja Thrashers. It's so wonderful. It is such a wonderful little pitch, just kind of joking about how blind Marvel is to some of the black characters that they were creating at the time. Have you seen that, Alan?
No. I do have good news about Marvel Unlimited. They have Deathlok, they have Damage Control, and for a moment there, I wasn't sure if that was true about the Soul of Cyberfolk. Yep, that is it. It says it, and I was stopped. I had to stop with Damage Control issue 3, where it's Damage Control the movie. That's just brilliance. There's a gap from 1994 to 2006, where from Captain Marvel to beyond, and he wrote six issues, and then would go from different book to different book. The World War Hulk After Smash Damage Control, he wrote that. And he also worked on Avengers Classic, which it was mainly a retelling of classic Avengers issues. And as for the gap in between 1994 and 2006, we'll get to that.
Yep. So I did share with you his pitch for Teenage Negro Ninja Thrashers. I don't know if you want to read it. It's only one page, so I figure we could probably knock it out here really quick. Do you want to read it? Do you want me to read it?
I would appreciate it if you could read it, because I cannot. The words are very small and...
Okay, I can read it. So, this was his pitch for Teenage Negro Ninja Thrashers. Dwayne McDuffie, proposal for a new series, Teenage Negro Ninja Thrashers, first draft, December 13th, 1989. In the past year, 25% of all African-American superheroes appearing in the Marvel Universe possess skateboard-based superpowers. In an attempt to remain on the cutting edge of comics, I hereby propose a new series that will fully exploit this exciting new trend, Teenage Negro Ninja Thrashers. When a group of teenage Negroes find cosmic-powered skateboards, their lives are forever changed. A team of distinct characters join together, swearing an oath to use their powers for good. Rocket Racer, a black guy on a skateboard. Night Thrasher, a black guy on a skateboard. Dark Wheelie, a black guy on a skateboard. And their leader, the mysterious black guy on a skateboard, known only as that mysterious black guy on a skateboard. This is a surefire hit, as it contains all of these popular elements. Circa 1974 clothing and hairstyles. Bizarre speech patterns unrecognizable to any member of any culture on the planet. a smart white friend to help them out of the trouble they get into. They're heroes who could be you if you were black. I mean, they're on skateboards. They have an attractive white female friend to calm them down when they get too excited. Face it, Pilgrim. This one's got it all. Have I made my point?
Okay, I'm going to, I don't know if you know this, but I got a certain vibe from that. and that vibe was Key and Peele.
Yeah.
can I please drop this fact that I'm always the first to drop?
Let me see. Yeah, I think I had it in the third episode, if it's the one I'm thinking of. But yeah, go right ahead.
In September of 2015, on episode 275 of the You Made It Weird podcast, Keegan-Michael Key talked about his family history as an adopted child and tracing his late biological father's family and finding that he had two half-brothers who had also passed away, one aged 45 and one aged 49. One who he described as having worked at DC Comics and Marvel Comics and for Warner's animation department, especially responsible for bringing characters of color on screen, and who died in 2011. So that's pretty clear who we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And what you just read, that just, it feels so much like something I would see on Key and Peele like 5 years ago.
He would fit in so well.
Yeah.
Writing for that show.
Man, I want to see this now.
Like, I think if you click on that image, it should pop up as a bigger. But yeah, I will put that on the site as well when we post. So race was also something problematic behind the scenes. McDuffie was one of the few black people working at Marvel during his tenure there. Racism was also pretty apparent from the sounds of it. There's one story that's told about an editor who kept a Sambo figurine on his desk. Do you know what a Sambo figurine is, Alan?
No.
I didn't know what it was either. Once you see it, you will know exactly what it is. I don't know if you're Googling it right now, but it's just like a typical racist caricature. This is probably not something I'm going to put on the site, but I mean, it's basically what you picture, like old cartoons from the, pure black kid with giant red lips.
Yeah, I'm going to bring up a wrestling thing, but that's fine because when I was about 18, 19, I worked at a comic book store and the owner told me, he explained that wrestling and comic books sort of go together in terms of, like, they have people who like one, like, tend to like the other.
I don't know if I would disagree with that. I think there's a lot of overlap.
There was a wrestler who, this was a pretty big thing that happened. He was told he was going to be basically a Jehovah's Witness character. And the shirt they had made for him as his official merchandise was basically that. And I think that changed him because he lost it. And strangely, that has not had any ramifications against the company that he worked for, which I will not mention WWE.
Is this wrestler still
wrestling? Still wrestling?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he is, but not for them.
Okay. I was trying to think of who it could be.
His character's name is Jordan Miles.
Oh, that's right. I remember that now.
Yeah, him.
That wasn't that far. Well, yeah, it wasn't that far back. It was what, like four? God, I can't remember now.
I think it was a year or two ago.
Was it only a year or two ago? God, I feel so much longer.
2020, man.
2020, yeah, I guess kind of feels like 4 years just in itself.
And now, back to the show.
So specifically regarding that story regarding the Sambo figurine, this editor always kept one on his desk. And so some of the black people who worked at Marvel, such as McDuffie and Dennis Cowan and some other freelancers, would spot it on his desk. And so they would walk by it and steal the figure anytime they could, only to find out that the editor would then replace it with a new one. And so this was furthered by other institutional racism prevalent with who spoke with who. Some artists at Marvel didn't want to be spotted talking to their black coworkers, and it would lead to other people being suspicious of them, quote unquote, planning something. It just sounds disgusting as to what the whole, I hate saying culture of Marvel was like at the time, but I have although a lot of what fueled Milestone was creator-owned content that wouldn't be influenced by higher-ups, part of me wonders if Dwayne McDuffie and Dennis Cowan partially created Milestone to get out of that kind of...
And make a statement?
Yeah. And I don't know what it's like today. I'm hoping it's a lot better. But at least...
I don't know about you, but I saw the... I posted it in the staff chat, or I think I did, Stanley video.
Is it the animated one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that one.
I mean, now that I live in a world where I've heard him say those words, they're not... It's not racist. It's just... It's like hearing your grandfather say curse words. I mean, my grandfather did, one of my grandparents did say cuss words, but I tried to forget about it.
Yeah, I remember, this got completely off topic here. So in high school, we had to interview a family member, preferably someone, you know, of an older generation. And I think the topic I either had to write about, or it was the topic of the class or something, was Martin Luther King Jr. And so I went to my grandfather, who is very much a racist. And it was so weird hearing him talk about Martin Luther King Jr., who was a very important man who did a lot of good for people, but he hated him because he was black. And it is so hard for me to wrap my head around, yes, this person is really good. He did amazing work. He, you know, was incredibly intelligent and used those brains of his to help further, you know, racial equality to people who were like him. But he was black, so he's boo, you know, bad. I don't like him. Like, it's
bad because of a minute feature.
Mm-hmm. Because of a something that occurred because of his birth. So they had no control over it. It's...
That'd be like me giving The Walking Dead's Survival Instinct a B+ on VGU.TV all those years ago.
You know, the whole reason I started all this was, you know, to touch on a Black History Month type of thing. And
this has spiraled into something else.
You know, it came to like Dwayne McDuffie and all this, but going over all this, it's so prevalent how things far have not changed. Yeah. Like, the industry has changed for the better in some ways, but at the end of the day, like, not only comics, but just this world in general still has so far to go. And it's sad that we are living in 2020 and this is still a huge problem, and that there's still people looking to keep people back because of the color of their skin, or, you know, what gender they want to identify as, or who they're sexually interested in, all this stuff. And I hope that at some point in the future, all that will change. I don't particularly have a lot of faith in that, especially after our recent elections where 73 million people seem to vote for people, someone who is very much against that idea. But there's always the hope. And people like Dwayne McDuffie help further that cause to make this world a better place, which is partly why I wanted to focus so much on Dwayne when I started really getting into the weeds of all this.
Well, there have you ever seen Star Trek Deep Space Nine?
I have not, no.
There's an episode called Far Beyond the Stars, where Benjamin Sisko, who is the main character of Deep Space Nine, wakes and finds that he's in 1950s Earth instead of on Deep Space Nine. And he works under a byline, and he basically creates Benjamin Sisko and Deep Space Nine. And the showrunner at the end of the show, at the end, like by the time the show was ending, Ira Behr, he was considering ending the show with having the character, the other role that Avery Brooks played on that episode, Benny Russell, having it end with him at Paramount. It's honestly one of the best pieces of science fiction I've ever seen, and is great social commentary. What rang true and what was being said 30 years ago is still rings true to these days, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. That's so sad.
And now, back to the show.
So throughout his time at Marvel, he would not only write books such as She-Hulk, Iron Man, Double Dragon, and Power Pack. He was also working on movie tie-in content, trading cards, and other content that was not comic book monthly products. But then in 1990, he would end up leaving Marvel, and he felt he had kind of reached as high up as he was allowed to go. Promotions felt like they were never going to come around, and he wanted to leave a mark, which he felt would best be done as a freelancer instead of an editor. And so during this time, he would bounce around between different publishers. So he would write stuff like The Tick, XO, Man of War for Valiant and Acclaim. He would write book.
This I did not know. I did not know he wrote XO Man of War.
Mm-hmm.
While it wasn't a character that I, or that while that book wasn't one that I had any love for, because by the time I was reading comics, Valiant was still dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Acclaim. But I'm shocked.
Yeah, Valiant's one of those companies I remember trying to get into a while back, and just it never really did much for me. But now you can find a lot of their books in the dollar bins. Like I know when I was searching today, I ran across a ton of these books. Just for whatever reason, I just didn't pick them up. But maybe I should. Maybe I should at least find McDuffie's work on it. Outside of working at Valiant and Acclaim, he also worked with DC. Doing stuff like The Demon and apparently a Prince comic. However, his claim to fame would be when Dennis Catlin would approach him with the idea for Milestone Media. And he, Dennis, Michael Davis, Christopher Priest, and Derek T. Dingle would all come together and form Milestone Media in the early 90s. All of them would leave their respective companies, mainly because they wanted control of the work they were doing while writing the stories and wanted to touch on characters that represented who they were. So they band together and changed the comic industry. And we will touch on that next week. So I don't have very many random trivia. Most of the stuff I found that would come later on. So for one, Damage Control was actually inspired by the Adam West Batman show. Specifically, he noted that when the Batmobile parachute would open, like anytime it had to make a turn, there was a label detailing on the parachute how people would come and pick it up. And so he decided to take that little random idea that people are, driving around Gotham, finding these little bits and pieces of Batman stuff and taking it back to him, and just expanded that into Damage Control. That Hulk versus Thor issue in Defenders number 10, they actually did end up finding it that fall, and Dwayne was very disappointed because their fight ended up in a tie. This one was something that, it's the last one I have, but if this happened, we may very well have never known who Dwayne McDuffie actually was. So Dwayne was almost murdered after moving to New York in the 80s. Apparently, one night in a subway station, he, a 6'7 black man, was alone with an elderly woman who was clutching her purse. He knew because of his physical features, both size and being black, that people might feel threatened of him, so he would often keep his distance to give them a sense of security. However, this old woman pulled out a gun and started firing off shots as the train was pulling in and missed on both attempts. And so, he dives to the ground as she fires off, I don't remember how many shots she tried, but then she stepped in to the train and left. And he reported it to the transit authority, who didn't care to help, didn't offer to follow up on this whatsoever. And so Dwayne went home. And this is how he claims he became a supporter of gun control.
My God.
So Dwayne McDuffie was almost murdered before any of us would have known who he was by some old ass white woman. So that's all I have for Dwayne McDuffie's life pre-Milestone. I do want to mention that Eugene Sun, who I mentioned had worked with Dwayne McDuffie in later years, after Dwayne died, he did some work on a website that would touch on different stories that Dwayne had told him, or just different, you know, things he would find along the way, or stories that he could tell. All of this would have to be found on the Wayback Machine, and I will have a link to it in my sources, so you can find that on, again, VG.TV.
The story you told, or the one you told, you mentioned a while ago, was just I just can't stop laughing. It's hard for me not to laugh when I look back at it.
Which one was that one?
It's the one where him and his partner were like, a woman made a comment.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I should tell that one here, considering some of the stuff he says. But yes, please go find, let me double check here. I think it's Web Old Archive, DwayneMcDuffie.com, lamppost. Pull it up here and double check here. Yeah, so I think the latest date that Wayback Machine pulls it up was December 9th of 2013. And there's a lot here. He posts, you know, different scripts from things Dwayne has done, different stories, you know, some of the stuff I told on this podcast, including, you know, that jungle action number six. And, I think the story of him being shot at, I think all of it came from this site. So please check it out. It's so cool to see all these different stories of Dwayne. And I don't think the site's up and running anymore. I think it actually leads to the charity or award site for the Dwayne McDuffie Award. But if you go through the Wayback Machine, it'll pull up all that old stuff too. So it's really cool, and everyone should check it out. But really, that is all I have. Is there anything else you want to add before we head out and come back next week to touch on Milestone?
Yeah. It's actually a quote that Dwayne, I don't know when he made this quote. He said, and I quote, "I think the biggest advice I can offer is don't just pick one story and stop. Write as much as you can, as many stories as you can. The best thing about being a writer is a writer's craft is nearly perfect because a writer can go anywhere and do his craft." Which is something I never thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oftentimes, like anytime someone would comment on Dwayne, it was always about how he was the smartest man in the room, basically. And anytime you hear him speak, you're like, yep, I can see that. That man is...
I think we're going to get to it when we talk about Milestone. But I forgot who I was watching an interview. I think it was with Dennis Cowan, where he mentioned that like he initially wanted to... I'm probably going to get something wrong because I tend to when I talk about stuff like this. About how instead of being just a company that puts out books about black characters only, Dwayne said something along the lines of like we can do more.
Mm-hmm.
And like a bit more, basically saying we can do stories about people who aren't represented. And that's one of the things I love about today's comic book landscape, with things like Comixology, where you can self-publish. So there's literally, once if you and an artist do a book, there's literally nothing stopping you from putting it out and potentially getting spotted to have things boom from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dennis, Dwayne, and all of them took a big chance with Milestone. You know, there's not a lot of companies that can come off the ground the way they did, especially being one shooting for diversity in the way that they were. And if I remember right, they were the company that sold or published more books than any other like Black Ram company prior to it. I have a feeling probably afterwards too. But yeah, now you don't have to take that sort of chance. You can just self-publish anywhere. And that's such an awesome idea that there could be a future Dwayne McDuffie who does not need to put that sort of risk in and have, you know, have the company backstab you in the end. you can just put it out there, get your name noticed, and I think it's working. I don't think it's where it needs to be, but I feel like there are definitely more creators who are not just straight white males making comics nowadays. And I feel like a lot of those building blocks came because of Dwayne.
Yeah, he's definitely a pioneer.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we're going to focus on Milestone and his work there. And all the stuff that he does post-Milestone as well. Because for someone who was taken so young, he has done so much. From comics to animation to... He has such a huge list of stuff that he's done. And not a lot of people can say that. And I'm glad we decided to focus so much on McDuffie for this month. And I hope that in the future, people will put him on the same pedestal that they do. Hell, he belongs on a higher pedestal than people like Alan Moore and Frank Miller and all them. You know, yeah, they were great writers and they helped change the industry, but they did not change it the way that Dwayne McDuffie did.
Yeah, Frank Miller is a horrible person. Alan Moore, horrible person. We had a running joke on Phantom Zone that Alan Moore was basically when things were going bad for DC or something is because he was doing Warlock stuff.
I almost did a spit take there.
Like doing snake rituals. And Dwayne McDuffie deserves to have, as you said, he did work on comics, film, television,
stand up,
and people are just now starting to. I'm gonna say people are just now. I mean, I'm talking about me, being able to read his work because prior to things like Marvel Unlimited and Comixology. You had to either go to a shop that luckily would have his work in it or eBay. But thankfully, that's not necessary anymore.
And hopefully that only improves with all the Milestone stuff coming up too.
Hopefully it does not get stopped like last time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and should we mention that we're going to have a guest with us on
the... Oh, for the fourth week?
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to go ahead and mention it?
Yeah, we're going to have Javon McNeil, who is my best friend. I've known him for 10 years now. Let's just say that, have you heard of the Super Best Friends?
Yep.
Do you remember the running joke of a character called Lucky Ted?
I do not know.
Well, they were doing the Dark Souls 3 LP, and they workshopped a character named Lucky Ted. Who had all his skills at zero, or all his stats at zero, but in luck he had like 100 or 99. And Javon is Lucky Ted.
I think I remember you mentioning he was Dan Reichert. The black Dan Reichert.
He's black Dan Reichert. But he has had so many cool things happen to him. Like he's been an extra in certain entertainment stuff. His cousin is an actor who was in the 50 Cent movie and played the guy who shot 50 Cent. And I'll tell this one. I'll wrap it up after this one. But and because it's just so crazy how life works. When I was about 13 in 2007, I watched G4's Attack of the Show, and he was on one multiple G4 stuff. He had a he made a random comment during one of the virtual audience things, like or viewer feedback loops.
I think I remember you posting that video for that.
Yeah, where he says, where it's like I'm talking about Halo 3's ending game. Leak.
Yeah,
and he made the right throwaway comment. Master Chief is chocolate. My best friend at the time would constantly quote that. Would constantly refer to that quote. And then me and that friend had a falling out, and I'm like, wow, I'm now friends with this dude. Life is strange.
Life is strange. I'm glad you're friends with him, because Javon's a really cool dude.
Yeah, like, we had him on an episode of the Black Panther episode of Phantom Zone when the guys tried to get Emmett, but they couldn't. So I just said, I know someone. And one of the other people, like one of the people who couldn't make the recording, was listening to it like, oh, who is this guy? And like, in a good way. Not like, who the hell, who is this MF-er?
It's hard not to like Javon.
Yeah, and yeah, the episode that we did, that me, him, and Emmett did of Players Club talking about G4 is pretty much has done the best out of all the podcasts we've done since rebranding, or since returning to G4, returning to BGU. So hopefully he brings up the numbers.
Brings that luck of his. Okay, well, that feels like a good kind of stopping point for us. Please rate, review, wherever you listen to this podcast on. That helps us in multiple ways, and we always appreciate it. Don't forget to also follow us on Twitter at HyperTimePod. If you have questions or suggestions for topics you would like us to cover, you can post them there. You can also email us at HyperTime2podcast@gmail.com. We can also be followed on VGU.tv, where you can find the show notes along with sources. I try and post pictures as well. And you can also find our other content regarding typically video games. So if you have any interest in that, please check it out. There's a lot of cool stuff going on there. The VGU Twitter, by the way, is at VGU_TV. There are also two other podcasts that we do for video games. One is the Players Club podcast, and the other is Win, which is the Week in News podcast we do. You can follow me on Twitter at JMILLE99. Alan, where all can they follow you at?
They can follow me on Twitter at the Almir, and it wouldn't be an episode of Hyper Time without an Alan tweet.
Alan, tweet of the week. Of the bye week.
The Dark Side of the Ring episode on, quote, the slap is a supreme education of, quote, the business.
I think I'm going to find a drop for your Twitter post each episode.
I mean, when I brought back DualShock Show from the Dead, you had the big question that I tried my best to do. Josh's big question.
Oh yeah.
And like the Alan Partridge style.
We might have to get like Javon to do that or something. We'll figure something out. I'll find some sort of drop in there for your tweets. But with that, I think that's all we have for this week. So we will check you out next week, not 2 weeks, next week, where we will talk about Milestone Media and all the fantastic stuff that came out of that. And so with that, we will bid you all adieu, and we will see you further down the Hyper Time. Take care. Bye.